We said that there were two main parts to photosynthesis, or two chemical reactions that are going to occur. We said that photosynthesis was the collection of sunlight energy and converting that energy into chemical bonds. And so the first part of photosynthesis is the collection of sunlight energy, and the second part is converting it into chemical bonds. We said that the first reaction is going to occur across the thylakoid membrane, the collection of sunlight energy, and then the converting of that energy into chemical bonds is going to occur in the stroma, in the chloroplast. Okay, so there are two different reactions. The first reaction is what we're going to call a light-dependent reaction, because it's dependent upon light. The second reaction is the light-independent reaction, and it needs light in order to run, but not directly. It kind of needs light indirectly. So let's talk about the first reaction, the light-dependent reaction. Sometimes it's called the Z scheme. Now when you look at it in this overhead, it looks more like an N instead of a Z. But the first guy who graphed it out had it tipped sideways, so therefore the name Z scheme. Basically what's happening here is molecules are going to be moved across the plasma membrane of the thylakoid membrane and make concentration gradients, which are going to, in turn, allow the cell to produce energy using enzymes. So the way in which this works is, if this were the plasma membrane here, the molecule that's going to be moved across the plasma membrane of the thylakoid, okay, is the element hydrogen. Now hydrogen is positively charged. So hydrogen has a positive charge. So what happens, let's say that we have a hydrogen on either side of the plasma membrane in equal concentrations. Okay. What happens is when the sunlight hits the thylakoid, it's like active transport. Remember we talked about ATP being used to move substances against their concentration gradient? The same principle applies here. What is moved across the plasma membrane are hydrogen ions. So as sunlight hits the plasma membrane, hydrogen ions are moved across the plasma membrane against their concentration gradient. Okay? And so what happens is we end up with more hydrogen inside of the thylakoid than we do outside of the thylakoid. Right? Now, if there's more hydrogen inside of the thylakoid, what do those hydrogen ions want to do? They want to diffuse across the plasma membrane, right? But they can't diffuse across because it's a semi-permeable membrane, just like any other membrane. But what we have here is we actually have some gated protein channels in the plasma membrane, a couple of different types of gated protein channels, and they have enzymes, and I'm going to draw the enzymes something like this, that are associated with those gated protein channels. Okay. Now what happens is when these gated protein channels open up, depending on which one it is, the hydrogen ions will diffuse across the plasma membrane. And as they diffuse across, they release some of their potential energy in the form of kinetic energy and allow some molecules, one of them is ATP, to be produced from ADP, and the other one is a molecule that is called NADPH. Okay, and it's produced from a molecule called NADP, and we'll talk about this molecule here in just a minute. If the hydrogen ions are allowed to go across that gated protein channel, okay. Now, when these hydrogen ions, before we talk about this anymore, when these hydrogen ions are moved to the moved across the plasma membrane, do they have any potential energy? They do, because they can what? They can diffuse across the plasma membrane. Let me give you an example that's very similar to this, okay? If you have a dam, what does the dam do in a stream?
Blocks the stuff.
It blocks the water. Does that water behind the dam have any energy? It does. That's how we get hydroelectric power, right? We open up the little gates on the dam that has a turbine in it, and the water goes through, turns the turbine, and that makes electrical energy. Okay, the same principle applies. Kind of imagine our dam, and instead of having a river behind our dam, we take a cup full of water from below the dam and we put it above the dam. Now that's not very much water, but the principle applies. That cup full of water, once it's behind the dam, then has some potential energy, more potential energy than it did have. Does that make sense? So the same principle applies. Instead of water in this case, we're using hydrogen ions. And as those hydrogen ions are moved against their concentration gradient, they do have potential energy. And so as they move across these gated protein channels, they release some of that energy, enough energy to form, in some cases, ATP, and in some cases, NADPH. Okay? Any questions about that? So here's what's happening in this graph here. Electrons are excited and they're bouncing across the plasma membrane, and they pull hydrogen ions with them. Does that make sense? So we're pulling hydrogen ions across the plasma membrane against their concentration gradient. As those hydrogen ions move through a gated protein channel, we can produce one ATP out of an ADP molecule. Okay? At that point, that gated protein channel closes, more hydrogen ions are moved across the plasma membrane, and as those hydrogen ions move through this other gated protein channel, a molecule called NADPH is produced out of a molecule that's called NADP. All right? Any questions that anybody has? So again, this is the first or light-dependent part of the of photosynthesis. And if you remember, our word definition was it was the collection of sunlight energy, right? So we're collecting sunlight energy in the form of ATP and NADPH. Now, ATP and NADPH are sometimes what we call high-energy intermediate molecules, meaning that they have a lot of energy, but they don't stay around for very long, okay? So let me give you an example. We use ATP as well as plants, right? Okay. Instead of athletes doping with some drug, why don't we just inject them with a whole bunch of ATP? That would be probably better in some instances, right? Why don't we do that? The answer is it has a lot of energy, but there are intermediates. So if you had a vial of ATP, that ATP would break down on its own over a short period of time. In other words, ATP is not a stable molecule. The same thing is true with NADPH. Does that make sense to everybody? So if you don't use it, you essentially lose it. All right? You lose the energy that's stored in that ATP molecule. Any questions? So in the light-dependent reaction, we produce, the plant produces ATP and NADPH, those two molecules, okay? Any questions about the light-dependent reaction? Now the light-independent reaction, and this is actually just another picture showing that, here's the gated protein channel that's associated with NADPH, the gated protein channel that's associated with ATP, okay? The second part of photosynthesis then is the conversion of that sunlight energy into chemical bonds. And that occurs again in the stroma. Now we have a couple of different names for this reaction. One is the light independent reaction. Another one, some of you might have heard of the Calvin-Benson cycle in high school. That's what we're going to talk about now. It's another name for it. Another name for this cycle is what we call it the C3 cycle. Okay. Now, I should mention that this whole C3 cycle, or Calvin-Benson cycle, is actually quite complex. What I hope that you guys will understand by the time we're done talking about photosynthesis today is basically how the C3 cycle works, okay, in the most basic of terms. When I was up at Utah State, I took a class from a professor that studied photosynthesis, and he had his whole wall about as big as this classroom, just little tiny chemical reactions that were occurring in photosynthesis. We're not going to get that detailed, okay? I just want you guys to have a general idea of what's happening there. So basically what happens is this, again, this occurs in the stroma. Now, in order to run the light independent reaction, notice what is needed here. Some energy is needed to run this reaction. Right here, this energy is what? NADPH, okay? Down here, there's an ATP. Up here, there's an ATP. So it takes energy to run the light independent reaction. Where does that energy come from to run the light independent reaction?
First reaction?
Yeah, the light dependent reaction. So this ATP and NADPH that we produced in the light dependent reaction is going to be used right away to run the what? Light independent reaction. Does that make sense to everybody? So remember, we had in photosynthesis the collection of sunlight energy, which we did in the light dependent reaction, and now we're going to convert that energy into chemical bonds. All right? Are there any questions about that? So this whole process takes energy. It takes at least two ATP and an NADPH molecule. Now, the first thing here that we want to look at is in this cycle, we start out with a molecule that has five carbon in it. And it's called ribulose bisphosphate. And I don't expect you to remember ribulose bisphosphate, but I do want you to realize that there is a molecule here that has five carbon in it. So you can actually see in this picture, you can count the little balls, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, okay? Now, essentially what's going to happen in this process is carbon dioxide is going to be fixed, all right? And so you actually see the carbon dioxide molecule represented right here. And so what's going to happen in the first step is this carbon dioxide molecule is going to be attached to this 5-carbon molecule to give us a 6-carbon molecule. And that should be fairly easy math for everybody, right? 5 plus 1 is 6. Now, all of you know that plants take in CO2 and give off O2, right? So the first step is they're going to do what we call fixed carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is going to be added to this 5-carbon molecule, ribulose bisphosphate, to make a 6-carbon molecule, okay? Any questions about that? Now, as you can see, there are a couple of intermediate steps after the carbon dioxide is added to this 5-carbon molecule. The 6-carbon molecule then splits in half to two 3-carbon molecules, and they go through some other chemical manipulations, okay? And eventually, what's going to happen is one of the molecules, one of the carbon from this 6-carbon molecule is going to be broken off and it's going to be converted into a sugar. Okay? So every time this process runs, there's an additional carbon that's added to sugars in the plant. And that's essentially an overall view of what's happening. Does that make sense to everybody? So how do plants grow? Well, they add carbon. How do they add carbon? They fix carbon dioxide in the process of photosynthesis, and that carbon that they fix, they're essentially going to add to a sugar molecule. If you remember, sugar molecules basically are ring structures most of the time that have carbon in the corners of the ring, so they have a lot of carbon. All right. Now, once that carbon is broken off from this molecule, the 2-carbon molecule and the 3-carbon molecule then bond together again to make ribulose bisphosphate. And what happens to this ribulose bisphosphate again? Picks up another CO2 and becomes a 6-carbon molecule. Then it breaks into 2 3-carbon molecules. Eventually one of those carbons are harvested and used to help produce a sugar. Then you have 5-carbon molecule again. And what happens to that 5-carbon molecule? It picks up a carbon dioxide. So it's a cycle. Okay, as long as the plant is alive and you have chloroplasts, this process and light, I should say, this process should be occurring. Okay, any questions about that? Now, one thing the plant does not need to use is the, if you think about CO2, that means we have carbon and how many oxygen? Two. Okay, actually, the molecule looks something like this. There are double bonds between those carbon and oxygen. And in all of these chemical manipulations, one of the things that needs to occur is to pull these oxygen off of the carbon. So we're trying to break those bonds, or the plant is trying to break those bonds between the carbon and oxygen. This carbon then is going to be added to other carbons to make sugar. Okay? That makes sense? And what's going to happen to these oxygen? They're not stable. So they can actually bond together to produce a molecule called O2, okay, which is oxygen that we breathe. And oxygen in this case, in this process, is a waste product. And so what happens is the plant actually gets rid of the oxygen and carbon dioxide and gives it off in the form of oxygen. And that kind of should make sense to you because you've all heard that plants take in CO2 and give off what? Oxygen or O2. Okay. Any questions about the light independent reaction? So if we look at where this process occurs again, in the light dependent reaction, it occurs across the membranes of the thylakoid. What is produced in the light dependent reaction are some molecules called ATP and NADPH when there's sunlight present, right? Okay. Now that ATP and NADPH is used where? In the light independent reaction. And basically what the light independent reaction does is it fixes carbon dioxide, gives off sugars, as you can see down here, okay, and then basically starts the cycle again. And this again occurs in the stroma. All right. Are there any questions about that? Now that's the basics of photosynthesis. But in fact, photosynthesis can be a little bit more complicated. There are a number of different types of photosynthesis that occur in different types of plants. There are four main types of photosynthesis. The first is what we call C3 photosynthesis, and that's kind of normal photosynthesis like we've been talking about. Okay? So C3 photosynthesis is basically what we've been talking about. Now, C3 plants actually have a problem. There's a problem with C3 photosynthesis that I didn't mention previously, but I'm going to talk a little bit about now. Okay? And that problem is this. When we're in the light independent reaction, the enzyme that fixes this carbon dioxide right here, there's an enzyme right here, what it's looking for is it's not actually looking for carbon dioxide, it's just looking for two oxygen molecules. Okay? So what other molecule do we know of that we've talked about just recently has two oxygens associated with it?
Water.
Okay, water has one oxygen and two hydrogen, right? Okay. We just talked about a molecule. Oxygen. Okay, it's a gas. And so what happens is this enzyme can sometimes pick up oxygen. Okay, and this process will run with just oxygen. But what is kicked out here as a product when oxygen enters this process? Is there any carbon that's kicked out here?
No.
There's not, because basically we're starting with a 5-carbon molecule and ending with a 5-carbon molecule. And so when oxygen gets in this process, it's something that we call photorespiration. Okay? So anytime photorespiration occurs, then it's basically wasted energy. And the movie that you guys watched last week, The Greening of Planet Earth, it talked about with increasing carbon dioxide concentrations, plants should grow better. Why?
They won't go through that much photorespiration.
Yeah, they won't go through.
There's more carbon dioxide.
Yeah, if there's more carbon dioxide in the air, the chances that they have oxygen to go through photorespiration go way, way down. Okay, and so basically, the plants are not going to go through photorespiration as much, and so they're not going to waste as much energy. They're going to be able to use that energy to grow. Okay, so anytime you have increasing carbon dioxide concentrations, it allows C3 plants to grow much, much better because they you don't go through any photorespiration. Any questions? Or less photorespiration, I should say, not any, but less. Any questions about that? Now C4 plants, which is another type of photosynthesis, C4 plants have a little bit different mechanism than C3 plants. Okay. Let's see if I can get one of the magic markers to work here. Now, in the C3 cycle, we have CO2 entering the C3 cycle. It goes through a kind of a circular cycle, right? And we end up giving sugars off from this process, correct? Okay. And what we said is that in C3 plants, oxygen or O2 can sometimes enter this process and mess things up in something that we call photorespiration, right? Well, C4 plants don't allow this to happen. They actually have another little cellular mechanism here that basically does not allow O2 to enter the process. Only CO2 can enter this pathway in a C4 plant. Okay, so it's kind of like there's a gatekeeper here. You can kind of imagine going to a jazz game. When you walk into a jazz game, before you can even get in the door, there's a little turnstile there, and before they let you through the turnstile, what do you have to have? You have to have a ticket in order to get into the jazz game, right? Same principle applies here. In order to get into the light independent reaction, you have to have the ticket of being CO2. Does that make sense to everybody? Okay. Now, that sounds like a pretty good deal, right? So are most plants out there, would you think that they're C4 plants around us, or C3 plants?
C3.
Actually, most of them are C3. But wouldn't C4 plants be more efficient?
Yeah.
In a lot of ways, they are. But the drawback, the downside of C4 photosynthesis is this. This gatekeeper, you're going to have to pay it if you're a plant. Okay? And what you have to pay it is ATP. Right? Just like the Delta Center, or I guess it's not the Delta Center now, whatever it's called, the jazz place. Okay? They have to employ people to take the tickets, right? Same principle applies here. There's a little gatekeeper here that only allows oxygen to get into this process, but the plant has to pay this gatekeeper in the form of ATP. So it actually takes more energy to run C4 photosynthesis. But in some ways it's more efficient. If you're in a sunny environment where there's plenty of sunlight, then C4 photosynthesis is actually more efficient because they can produce tons and tons of ATP in the light dependent reaction. Okay.
What's an example of a C4
plant? Many of your grasses are actually C4 plants.
Okay.
Corn is a C4 plant. And when there's plenty of sunlight, C4 plants can actually grow much more quickly many times than C3 plants. So let me just talk a little bit about, show you a graph here, okay? On the x-axis we have as light intensity increases, okay? On the y-axis we have net photosynthetic rate increasing, yeah?
I have a question. When would be a time that only oxygen would try to get into CO2, does that make sense? Like when would be a time that there wasn't any carbon dioxide?
Most of the time there is some carbon dioxide, but if you were to put them into an oxygen tent, for example, they wouldn't grow, but they'd be constantly photosynthesizing. Okay. So kind of ignore this C3 shade plant down here. So as light intensity increases, if we look at the C3 plant, the photosynthetic rate increases, but then it levels off. Now why does that happen? Does that make sense to you? If sunlight increases, would you expect photosynthetic rates to increase? Sure, because you're going through the light-dependent reaction more, and therefore you can go through the light-independent reaction more. Okay, so photosynthetic rate should increase. Why does it level off at some point?
The ones that also will shut down like in midday, they won't photosynthesize.
Okay, let's say that we have plenty of water, so that's okay. Not an issue. They actually all do shut down in the middle of the day, many of them. Why does the photosynthetic rate level off then? Well, if you think about it, what we've just been talking about, photorespiration. At some point, the CO2 concentration is going to be about equal to the oxygen concentration because plants give off O2 as a result of photosynthesis, right? And that O2 could just hop right back into that cycle and cause photorespiration to occur. So as sunlight increases, there's a point at which C3 plants cannot photosynthesize any faster because the oxygen concentration is going to be about the same as the CO2 concentration. So the plant's going to go through photorespiration as many times as it does the actual producing sugar part of the light independent reaction.
Okay. How long does this whole photosynthesis thing take, like, on average?
How long does it take?
Yeah.
To produce what? To fix one carbon? Milliseconds. Okay, so fast. In C4 plants, however, with increasing sunlight, the photosynthetic rate almost increases indefinitely. Why?
Because it blocks the oxygen from getting back to
you. Okay, it blocks the oxygen, and not only that, but if you have more sunlight, you have more energy to do what? To pay the gatekeeper, so you can allow more CO2s in. Does that make sense? Okay. Now we could draw a similar graph to this. They don't have a professionally done one here. But if this were net photosynthetic rate here on the y-axis, just like on that one there, but on the x-axis, instead of having sunlight intensity increasing, what if we had CO2 concentration, and this is increasing CO2 concentration, okay? What would you expect out of a C3 plant with increasing CO2 concentrations? It should have kind of indefinite growth, right? So CO2 concentrations, C3 plants would do best in a pure CO2 in an area where there's 100% CO2. That makes sense to everybody? What about C4 plants? What would their graph look like? Actually, it would flatten out. Why? So this is C4. C3. Yeah.
Because they never photo respiration anyways.
Yeah, they never photorespire, and so what happens is it doesn't matter what the CO2 concentration is out in the atmosphere. As long as there's some CO2 out there, your gatekeeper is only going to allow CO2 in, regardless. Okay. Any questions about that? So there are advantages and disadvantages to both types of photosynthesis. Any questions about C3 or C4 photosynthesis? Now there's actually a third type of photosynthesis that we're going to talk about. It's called CAM photosynthesis. Now you don't need to remember what this acronym stands for, as far as I'm concerned, but if you want to know, it stands for crosylation acid metabolism. All right? And this type of photosynthesis occurs in what we call succulent plants, or plants that have evolved to live in a very, very dry environment. So succulent plants, and a couple of examples would be a cactus. If you've ever noticed, a cactus has a stem that's really juicy. You guys ever notice that? That's a succulent plant. They go through CAM photosynthesis. Another plant that goes through CAM photosynthesis that you might be familiar with is aloe vera. Have you ever cut into the leaf of an aloe vera plant? It's really juicy on the inside, okay? And it goes through CAM photosynthesis. Aloe vera actually evolved in a desert environment. Now, in plants that live in deserts, the most limiting factor obviously is going to be water, right? Water is very, very limiting in desert environments. So, when is the plant going to lose water in relationship to photosynthesis? When do the stomates need to be open? Do they need to be open for the light-dependent reaction? Let me think about this for a minute. Are there any gases that are needed for the light-dependent reaction? There's not. So you could actually run the light-dependent reaction in without having your stomates open. Does that make sense? What about the light-independent reaction? Do the stomates need to be open for the light-independent reaction? They do, because you have to have CO2 coming in and oxygen leaving the plant, right? Okay. So when the stomates are open, not only do you get CO2 in and O2 that's leaving the leaf, but you're also going to lose some water in the form of evaporation, okay? Now, why don't the plants just go through the light-dependent reaction during the day and the light-independent reaction at night?
ATP doesn't last that long.
Yeah, ATP and NADPH don't last that long. It's very simple answer. They're high-energy intermediates, okay? And so what happens in CAM photosynthesis is they've actually overcome that problem by converting ATP and NADPH into a different form of energy, all right? So what happens in cam plants is that we have the light dependent reaction here, the Z scheme, okay? I'm just gonna draw it like that. And what's produced is ATP and NADPH, right? From this Z scheme. Everybody okay with that? What the CAM plant does is it has a little storage bin for energy storage. And what it does is it converts the ATP and the NADPH into something that we're going to call crystallation acid. Again, I don't really care if you remember the name crystallation acid. Okay. Then when nighttime comes around, they open up their stomates, and they can do this with their stomates closed, right? So they're not losing any water. At nighttime, when it cools down, they can open up those stomates, convert crystallation acid into ATP and NADPH, and then that is available to run the light independent reaction. At night, so less water is lost. Sound pretty good? Sounds like a good way to photosynthesize, right? What's the drawback here?
That's the way to remind
you. Would you? What's that? That's... Go ahead. Yeah.
Has to wait till night to photosynthesize.
Okay, it has to wait till night. And what?
There's more energy turning into the CA.
Yeah, actually, anytime you convert energy from one form to another, you lose some as heat, right? So where's energy lost in this process? Here and here. Okay. So in order to go through this light independent reaction, the plant actually has to go through many more light dependent reactions to run this light independent reaction, because we're converting energy back and forth into different forms, so some of it's going to be lost every time you have energy conversion. Just let me give you an example of this. If you were to plant a cactus out in your flower garden and then just leave it and allow the flowers and the cactus to kind of compete for resources, which one grows faster, your flower or your cactus? Flower. Why does the flower grow faster?
Because it doesn't need so much sunlight to run its photosynthesis.
Okay, it doesn't need as much sunlight. Also, it's more efficient. Whatever sunlight's there, they can actually use right away. Does that make sense? Okay, so the cactus isn't going to grow as fast. So, have you ever noticed where it's not dry, we don't have cacti? Okay, and the reason why is because the cactus plant can't keep up as far as growth rates to compete with other types of plants. Right. Any questions about CAM photosynthesis? Okay, so we have three types of photosynthesis, C3, C4, and CAM photosynthesis. Any questions about photosynthesis before we move on to respiration?
I thought you said there were four of them.
There's three main photosynthetic pathways we're going to talk about. The next energy processing pathway then is respiration. Respiration is going to occur in organisms that are heterotrophs, such as our cells. It's also going to occur in autotrophic cells. All cells need to respire. Okay. Now let's go back. Can anybody remember the word definition for respiration? Anybody remember? Remember, sunlight was the conversion of sunlight energy into chemical bonds. Respiration was the conversion of those chemical bonds into useful energy, namely what? ATP. Okay. So in this process, we're going to take chemical bonds, break them apart, harvest the ATP so that the cell can have energy to run. All right. So what we're going to use as an example molecule is glucose. Glucose has a chemical formula of C6H12O6. The most important thing about glucose here is that it has six carbons, and we'll talk quite a bit about glucose a little bit later on. In order to run this process, what do we need to take in? Oxygen, right? And you all knew that. We have to take in oxygen, and we're going to give off what? CO2. In that process, we're also going to produce water and we are going to produce a lot of useful energy, or ATP. All right? Any questions about that? Now, in order to get this process to run, we have to input energy as well. It's kind of like, remember, rolling the rock down the hill? Before we can roll it down the hill, we actually have to push it or input energy. Okay? So we're going to have to input some energy, and that's what this is talking about here. So I'm going to talk about respiration in a number of different ways. And what I'd like you to do is to kind of start copying this this picture here. What I found is that students, this is one way that I think students can really start to learn basically what's happening in respiration. So start up here in this left-hand corner, and if you don't get done, you're going to see this same slide a number of times. Okay? So start up in that corner. So one modification I want you to make here is also make a little box, kind of like these blue boxes here. Make a blue box, or it's not going to be blue and with just your pen. Make a little box right here. You're going to give that a name and talk about that reaction right there. We're also going to use some tables to show what's happening in respiration as well. Now, as we talk about respiration, it's a very complex process, to tell you the truth. But what we're going to do is we're just going to talk about the basics of how respiration occurs. Okay? And in respiration, there are four major chemical reactions that are going to occur. The first is what we call glycolysis. The second is what we're going to call the acetyl-CoA reaction. And that's the reaction that's going to occur in this graphic representation in this little box right here. Okay. And then the third reaction is what we call the citric acid cycle. All right. The fourth reaction is the one that you see down in this box down here, called the electron transport chain. So those are the four chemical reactions that we're going to talk about. Now, just to kind of simplify things and so you understand what you need to know about respiration, if you can tell me a number of things about each of these chemical reactions, then that's really what I expect you to know about respiration. The first thing that I want you to know is where these reactions occur. Okay? So we're going to write down here where they occur. We're also going to put it on this graphical representation. I want you to know what goes in as far as what types of chemicals go into this process. I want you to know what comes out as far as what types of chemicals come out of this process. I want you to know how much ATP is produced, okay, which is energy. I also want you to know how much energy intermediates are produced. Now, we talked about high energy intermediates in photosynthesis. The high energy intermediate in photosynthesis was NADPH. In respiration, we're going to introduce you to two other high-energy intermediates. One is called NADH, very similar to the molecule in photosynthesis, only the one in photosynthesis was NADPH, right? Okay. Another high-energy intermediate is FADH. And then we're going to get some waste out of this process, and the waste is going to be in the form of what? Not looking at oxygen goes in, what's going to come out as waste?
Carbon dioxide.
Okay, so how much carbon dioxide is produced? Alright? So if you can tell me all of those things about each of these chemical reactions, that's basically what you need to know for respiration, excuse me. Okay? Now remember our word definition of respiration, the breaking of chemical bonds to produce useful energy, namely ATP. Okay? So the first chemical reaction is glycolysis. Alright? Now, in glycolysis, the first question that I'm going to answer on this table is what goes in, and it actually shows you up here. What goes into the process of glycolysis?
Glucose.
Glucose. Now, actually, other things can go into this process. We're going to use glucose just as an example molecule. Does that make sense to everybody? So it's glucose is our example. So if we ask what goes in, it's glucose. And how many carbons does glucose have?
Six.
Six carbon. Okay. We're going to put a little six in parentheses below glucose. And that's going to be fairly important. You need to really understand that glucose has six carbon. Right. Now the next question is, where does it occur? If we look at this next picture here, glycolysis, it says, occurs in the cytosol. And where's the cytosol? Do you remember that? That's another review question that you should know already. Okay, it occurs in the cytoplasm. The cytosol is the liquid that surrounds all of the organelles in the cell. Remember that? Okay. So that's where it occurs. Where do you think most of this process of respiration is going to occur? Where would you guess? There's a hint on this picture here. In the mitochondria. And why would you expect it to occur in the mitochondria? What do we call the mitochondria? The power plant of the cell. That's where ATP is going to be produced, right? So this is the only one of the four chemical reactions that does not occur in the mitochondria. All right, we're going to talk about specifically where in the mitochondria in here in a minute on the other chemical reactions. But it occurs in the cytoplasm. Okay. Now, here's what I want you to know about glycolysis. In glycolysis, it occurs in the cytosol. Notice glucose is a six carbon molecule. So we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. What essentially is going to happen through a multi-step process is we're going to break this six carbon molecule down into 2, 3 carbon molecules. So we're going to break the molecule in half. Okay, everybody okay with that? So really what happens is we break a six carbon molecule called glucose into two molecules that we call pyruvate, and they are 3 carbon each. Any questions? So in this process of glycolysis, we're going to break down a 6-carbon molecule into 2, 3 carbon molecules. Just to kind of give you an idea, this is, again, a multi-step process. This particular overhead shows how this multi-step process occurs. It takes 4 or 5 chemical steps. We're not going to worry about that in this class. What I want you to know is that you start out with a 6-carbon glucose molecule. You end up with 2, 3 carbon pyruvate molecules. Any questions? Now, in order to get this whole process of respiration going, we need to input 2 ATP, right? So it's kind of, again, like pushing the rock off the top of the hill. In order to get the rock rolling, you first of all have to what? Give it a little push. And the little push that's given to the process of respiration is 2 ATP molecules, so we use 2 ATP. Notice here that 4 ATP are given off in the process of glycolysis. So if we ask how many ATP are produced, we could actually put up here 4 minus 2, right? Because there's 4 gross ATP that are produced. How many net ATP are produced? 2, right? Okay. So you can kind of liken this to an investment. If you invested $2 and you got 4 out, how much money have you made?
$2.
You made $2, right? That makes sense to everybody. So we invest 2 ATP to get this whole process going, and we harvest 4 ATP out of the process of glycolysis. Okay. So that's the first energy that's harvested out of the process of glycolysis. In addition, we're going to harvest 2 high-energy intermediate molecules called NADH. So over here, we're going to harvest 2 NADH out of this process. Okay. Any questions about that? Okay. Now, as far as FADH and CO2 are concerned, we're not going to produce any of those, all right, in the process of glycolysis, so we can put zeros there. So if we think about this process of glycolysis, we can actually use this graphical representation if you want. We have a glucose molecule that has how many carbons entering this process? Has 6 carbons. And what happens to glucose in the process of glycolysis?
It gets broken in half.
It gets broken half, and we make 2-3 carbon molecules called what? Pyruvate. That shows it right here. So we know what goes in, what comes out, right? Where does glycolysis occur? In the cytosol. So you could actually write in this little box here in parentheses cytosol if you want, right? Okay. Now notice there's a line that goes from glycolysis over here to ATP. So how many ATP are produced in the process of glycolysis? Okay. There are 2 net produced, but there are 4 gross that are produced, right? So in this line here, you might want to write 4 minus 2. That kind of makes sense how this graph is working. Some students actually, this saves them when they're trying to study about respiration. Right? What else is produced in glycolysis? What other products besides ATP?
NADH.
NADH. There's 2 of those that are produced. Now, notice there's this little box with an, or a little circle here with an H. There's a line from glycolysis to this little circle with an H. That represents high energy intermediates. So along this line, we might want to write 2 NADH are produced. Okay. Now what's eventually going to happen to NADH, just without even knowing anything about respiration, what's going to eventually happen to NADH if we follow the lines? It's going to go through a process called what? The electron transport chain, and it's going to produce ATP eventually. Does that make sense to everybody? Okay, any questions about glycolysis? All right, the next chemical reaction then is the acetyl-CoA reaction. The acetyl-CoA reaction occurs right here. Now, the first question is, what goes into the acetyl-CoA reaction?
2 pyruvates
that are 3 carbon each, right? So how many times do we need to run the process of the acetyl-CoA reaction, do you think?
Twice.
We need to run it once for each of the 3 carbons, so that would be a total of 2. Does that make sense? Okay, so each 3-carbon group has to go through this process. Next question we can answer is, where does it occur? Well, if you look up here, it says it occurs in the matrix of the mitochondrion. Where's the matrix of the mitochondrion again? Remember, it has that highly folded inner membrane. The matrix is inside of the highly folded inner membrane. So that's where this reaction is going to occur. So where it occurs, we can say the matrix of the mitochondrion here. Right. Now what comes out? We have to run this process 2, right? So we put, first of all, 1 pyruvate in, and notice what comes out. A molecule called acetyl-CoA. And how many of those are going to come out per glucose?
2.
2, right? Because we put what?
2
pyruvate in. Okay. So we go through this process 2. Is there any questions about that? Now notice what's happening here. These acetyl-CoA molecules, instead of being 3-carbon, are 2-carbon. So essentially, just basically, what's happening in the acetyl-CoA reaction? We're taking a 3-carbon molecule, and we're doing what to it? We're making it into a 2-carbon molecule. So what are we doing?
Taking out a carbon.
We're taking out a carbon. All right. Now, back to our word definition of respiration. What did we say respiration was? The breaking down of chemical bonds to make what?
Useful energy.
Are we breaking chemical bonds here?
Yeah.
Yes, we are. Okay. We're going to get energy harvested out of this acetyl-CoA reaction. Okay. Now, how much energy? Well, not a lot of energy. We only get 1 molecule of NADH that is produced in the acetyl-CoA reaction. Okay. 1 molecule of NADH. Now that's for every pyruvate. So how many total NADH are going to be produced per glucose in the acetyl-CoA reaction?
2.
That's a whole mouthful. The answer, right answer is, you heard it here, 2. How did we get that answer?
2 sets.
Yeah, we have to run through this process 2, right? There are 2 pyruvates. So the first pyruvate goes through, we harvest an NADH. Second pyruvate goes through this process, we harvest an NADH. Okay, any questions about that? In addition, we're going to have waste that's produced. What's the type of waste that's produced?
CO2.
So when we split off this carbon, we need to get rid of it by adding two oxygen molecules, right? Okay. So in the acetyl CoA reaction, we have two CO2 that are given off. Now the reason why there's two CO2 is we run through this process what?
Twice.
Once for each of the pyruvate. Okay. Now let me ask you a question. Just see how. Stick with me for just a couple of seconds here. Okay. What do we breathe in? O2. What do we breathe out? CO2. Why do we breathe in O2? To get rid of waste carbon. Okay. So carbon is broken off. We add the two oxygens from the O2 molecule, and we get CO2. Now, notice here, before we leave real quick, there's zero ATP produced and zero FADH. Okay. So again, if we look at this picture here, in the acetyl-CoA reaction, we have two pyruvate that come in, they're three carbon each, two acetyl groups that are two carbons each that come out of the reaction. We also have two CO2 that are produced, so there's a line directly to CO2. You could actually write two right here. We produce some high-energy intermediate. What type and how much? 2NADH, right? So we could write 2NADH on this little line right here, correct? Okay. And where does it occur? We could also put that in our box in parentheses. In the matrix of the mitochondria. Okay. Any questions? Okay, on Monday we're going to hopefully finish up the process of respiration. On Wednesday, remember there is a test, and the test will probably cover respiration. Okay. So read ahead so that you don't have too much studying to do Monday night.
Tuesday the test.
Tuesday's when the test is scheduled, 5th.
Just one day.
Yep. Anytime you want to take it. So the testing center, I believe, is open from 9 until, is it 9 or 10 now?
9 until 10:30.
Okay. So make sure you kind of plan and give yourself plenty of time.